will call to order the Tuesday, March 22nd, meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions. And we are lacking one member on the Senate side for a quorum, so we will not be taking action on a few of the items, but we will start taking testimony on the different bills that we have in front of us. And the first bill that I'd like to take testimony on tonight is our first bill on the agenda, which is the, pardon me if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly, but it will be the Clarion-Bolvey Fire Relief Association. So, members and Representative Anzels, I saw him. If you want to start coming forward.
Mr. Chair, it's Coleraine.
I knew somebody from up there would help me with the pronunciation. And I just, no offense,
well,
Representative Anzels, but I was glad that it was Senator Saxhog.
I understand.
So with that, I'm going to, before we get started, ask Rachel, our assistant director, our deputy director, excuse me, of the Pensions and Retirement Commission, to kind of give us a little background, and then Representative Anzels, we will go to you for the testimony and the setup on this. So with that, Rachel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a bill that will permit the consolidation of the Coleraine and Bovee Volunteer Firefighters Relief Association into the combined Trout Lake Volunteer Firefighter Relief Association to take effect on September 1st of 2016, rather than the statutory effective date of January 1st, 2017. And then Section 2 of the bill just requires the newly formed Relief Association to report the number of active firefighters as of September 1st, 2016, so that the Department of Revenue can accurately calculate the 2016 minimum fire state aid. So kind of the issue is that it will allow the two consolidated BFRAs to take effect in time for the Department of Revenue to appropriately and accurately calculate the applicable 2016 fire state aid.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Barth at this point on the introduction? Seeing none, I'm going to then ask Representative Anzels and Senator Saxhog is also the co-author from the Senate on this to begin backgrounding the commission from their experience on it. Representative Anzels, welcome to the Pension Commission, sir. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And again, you know how to identify yourself for the record. So,
Representative Anzels, this is my first appearance before your committee, and hopefully it'll go well. I apologize that the legislation is not officially before you yet, but we have had it drafted, and it will be officially introduced, I believe, tomorrow in the House and shortly in the Senate as well. Members, Bovee and Coleraine are two municipalities with two volunteer fire departments that have been around for 107 years. These are two municipalities and two volunteer fire departments that are separated by a highway. But of course, there's more to the story than that. Bovee was the community where the miners worked, and Coleraine was the community where the bosses of the mining companies out east lived and worked. So it's taken that many years to get these communities and these two volunteer fire departments to come together. It's good government. They are working very, very hard at raising funds to build a new public safety building, which will be located along the two communities. And this legislation, and the reason why we're here, as has been explained, is necessary in order to comply with the funding stream, the state fire aid money. And so that's why we're here. And I ask for your support. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And two members of the new department, now called the Trout Lake Volunteer Fire Department, are here in the gallery as well in case you have additional questions.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. And I will ask for member questions, but I also know that your two testifiers came from quite a distance, and so if they would like to share something with the commission, we're certainly happy to hear from them, and I know that they're available for questions, but if they would like to make a statement or two to the commission, we're certainly open to that. Again, they did come quite a distance, so.
That's very nice of you, Mr. Chair. They are available if needed.
Very good. Members, questions for Representative Anzalz? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask counsel, Ms. Lencheski or Ms. Barth, about the part that's in the background information about that the state aid to Bovee and the state aid to Coleraine. And jointly, do they receive... Can they receive aid?
Ms. Barth.
So, Representative Murphy, the problem is that the fire department consolidated before December 31st, 2015. So that's the fire district that the Department of Revenue looks at. But the concern is for the 2016 fire state aid. The problem is, though, the fire department is now associated with two relief associations. So the department can figure out what the initial fire state aid is, but they can't. There's no guidance in statute to distribute it to two different relief associations. So that's really the problem. And also, they cannot determine if the new fire department would be eligible for minimum state aid, which helps those relief associations that receive the smallest amount of initial fire state aid in the state, which could be potentially a really big financial impact on some of the smaller relief associations. And they would actually, if you look at the chart on the, I guess it'd be the third page, you can kind of see the timeline for what would happen if they did not receive this legislation and then how the legislation fixes it so that they do receive their fire state aid.
Representative Murphy, follow-up.
So, Mr. Chair, do we have to write in legislation that would allow this Department of Revenue to determine what the state aid for the joint fire district that the joint fire district could receive, or do we have to have revenue give us more information?
Ms. Barth.
So Representative Murphy, I've actually worked with the Department of Revenue in making sure that this legislation will fix the problem, and it was purely the consolidation date, because right now it's sort of a default consolidation date, and because the relief associations did not consolidate at the same time as the fire department, their consolidation won't technically be effective until January 1st of 2017. So this just moves that consolidation date forward to allow the Department of Revenue to properly calculate and then distribute the fire state aid.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Barth, then 166859 has the correct language in it?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Representative Murphy, follow-up?
No.
Representative Thiessen.
No, that.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Barth, with the possibility of more consolidations coming down the line, this piece of legislation has set the benchmark for more to be able to figure out what the associations and the state aid will be, correct?
Senator Rosen.
Ms. Barth.
Yes, consolidations are pretty rare to begin with. So this is the first time this sort of situation has ever come up. So I suppose it does give sort of a way of figuring it out if for some reason this were to happen again. But the State Auditor's Office and the Department of Revenue are really good at teaching fire departments who are considering consolidation kind of what their deadlines are. So this is more just kind of a first instance.
Members, before we go any further, we do have a quorum present, so I'd like to officially call the meeting to order. And Senator Saxhawk, if you had a chance to review the minutes from the meeting of March 15th.
Good enough, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxhawk moves the minutes from March 15th. Any questions or corrections? Hearing none and seeing none, all those signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right. Senator Rosen, you were in the middle of questioning. Did you get your question answered or other follow-up? Other questions for the author, either the House or the Senate author? The Senate author really hasn't had much to say tonight on it, so maybe we can ask him a question if he wants to comment on it.
If somebody wants to ask me what the Senate file is, Mr. Chair, I have that. Senate file 3158.
Thank you, because I know that our director and deputy director will be wanting to track that number, and you did to indicate that it was being introduced here, so great. Members, other questions? Representative Anzels, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other point I would make is that the state auditor has been consulted with the legislative solution to this and is fine with our solution. The auditor audits volunteer fire departments, as you know.
Anyone else from the public that would like to testify on the matter before the commission this evening? Seeing none and hearing none, I would ask Senator Saxhog if you'd like to move to include this in our omnibus bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move to include.
Senator Saxhog moves that revisor number 16-6859 and its accompanying House and or Senate number be moved for adoption and included in the 2016 Omnibus Pension Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Anzels. And gentlemen, thank you for coming down and being available for questions. We do appreciate it. Our next item is going to be Representative Hornstein and Thiessen, so if they would like to start readying themselves for the discussion, I will turn to Ms. Lincheski to ask her to give us some background on this as well. Ms. Lincheski. And with that, Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. The proposed or the draft bill in front of you is relates to the Fairview Hospital employees. Two meetings ago, we addressed this same group or some legislation that affected this same group of people. And if you might recall from that meeting, this is a group of employees who were spun out of the bigger system, the University Hospital system, back in 1996. And then continued to retain a benefit under the MSRS plan. At the time of that spinoff or that transaction, a number of benefits were given to this group in particular, one of which was enhanced augmentation. That was really the topic that was under discussion at our meeting a couple times ago. That proposal is not part of this this piece of legislation. So we won't be needing to discuss the augmentation rate in connection with this. So the bill in front of you addresses an exception to enhanced augmentation, which provides that the enhanced augmentation rate of 5.5 and 7.5 will continue until either of two circumstances come up. The first is that if the Fairview employee returns to public service, then the augmentation rate drops to 2%. Which is the same rate as everybody else in MSRS. And then the second exception is that if the Fairview employee begins to receive an annuity from MSRS, then the rate drops in that instance as well. So the bill amends the first of the two exceptions. So the bill then provides that Section 1 of the bill deletes the reference to that first exception and then expands on the exception, and that's in Section 2 of the bill. In that case, the Fairview employee, then is entitled to the greatest of three annuities. The combined service annuity is one calculation that would have happened in any event, and this, of course, is when the employee returns to public service, they would begin accruing a benefit under another pension plan, so they would be entitled to the combined service annuity. Or the third option is coverage under more than one fund. That would have been another calculation that would be done under the bill. And then the first option is the one really that focuses in on the enhanced augmentation going away. And in that case, the calculation is assuming the enhanced augmentation stays in place, but then reducing that benefit, the resulting benefit, by the benefit that the Fairview employee has accrued in the new position upon return to public service. And that's a dollar-for-dollar offset. So the idea is that you look at these three calculations. The best of the three is the benefit that the Fairview employee will receive. So the third, or actually Section 3 of the bill, makes the effect it addresses the case of somebody who is already receiving an annuity. So the bill has a retroactive effect back to January 1 of 2015. So in the case of one particular constituent who has been receiving a pension under the old language, or what is really the current statute right now, that person's benefit will be sort of recalculated, and then she will get the additional increment above what she's currently receiving in a lump sum, along with the first payment of the larger benefit. So that addresses that particular situation. It would be put into a session law and not codified, because it does just address this one particular situation. The amendment? That's the amendment as well.
What we'll do is we'll take the amendment in just a moment. What I'd like to do is I'd like to first of all welcome Representative Hornstein and Senator Dibble to the commission. And with that as the background, ask you gentlemen to state your name for the record and fill in anything that you feel that we need to know at this point that Ms. Lincheski may not have provided us, and if there are any testifiers that you'd like to have visit on the matter. So with that, I'm not sure which is you is going
to
go first.
I can start.
It was by default. Sorry, Representative Hornstein.
No, that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Well, I'll start, and Senator Dibble will fill in the blanks here. But we are Representative Hornstein from District 61A.
Thank you, sir.
Our concern here is with, as Ms. Lincheski pointed out, an employee who was under the understanding and really planned their life around this larger percentage that they had gotten and earned through employment at Fairview, and then the individual shifted to a position as a substitute teacher, and then as a result was in the TFA system and at a much lower rate and a much smaller benefit. And so there's a real fairness issue, because then with the benefit reverting back to that substitute teacher benefit, there was a loss of significant loss of potential income that was earned through the Fairview service that was that individual's career and life. And so when the individual was notified of that, we were then notified of this situation and would like to rectify it through legislation. And that's what's before you. So the idea is that the individual will be able to revert back to the larger benefit that was earned and accrued through the Fairview employment and not be penalized for actually, you know, doing very part-time substitute teaching, which is the result of what happened.
Senator Dibble, welcome.
Thank
State your name for the record.
Senator
proceed.
Scott Dibble, Senate District 61. And I will first open with the proviso, the caveat that I'm running to catch up on a lot of details on this particular subject. And actually, I was actually unaware that this had been prepared, and so I haven't even read the legislation very closely, because Representative Hornstein is so on top of things. But I just wanted to say, in our conversation with our constituent, the only point I wanted to emphasize was that when he went to work as a substitute teacher, he it was very, very part-time, and never really and worked very, very few hours all in all. And I don't think ever would have received the benefit of any sort from the TFA system. Yet he found out through the feature of the I think it was the law that should he ever touch public services again, he would then automatically lose that negotiated benefit that was negotiated on his behalf when the university system was taken over by Fairview. Even subsequent to that time that he served as a substitute teacher, he was continuing to get his statements, and they had, you know, the projected benefit that he might expect to receive if he retired at, you know, certain ages. And he made a lot of his life and career decisions on that representation that he was seeing on his own statement. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get him here today or get copies of those statements. He saved those as an exhibit, and we can get those for you. I mean, he was making a lot of his own personal career and professional development decisions on what he anticipated his projected retirement income to be. So needless to say, he's quite surprised when he found out about this particular development. I haven't read this language, so I don't know if this solves his problem or not to his satisfaction. I don't think he had a hand in crafting this language, and so I don't think he's had an opportunity to read it or respond to it himself.
Members, questions for Representative Hornstein or Senator Dibble? And then I think we're also going to hear from the Executive Director from MSRS on this as well as we get some background. But I just want to take it step by step. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to hear from Mr. Bergstrom, and it sounds like the number of people we're talking about is one, potentially, or we don't know. But you had a constituent that came to you with this concern.
Senator Pappas, my understanding is they have one. There may be others.
There may be others.
I think that's one of the things that we may want to visit with Mr. Bergstrom on.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, something that we haven't done in a long time, and I admit we didn't do it much when I was chair either, is look at our principles of pension policy. And I just wanted to maybe ask our staff to help us, or members who have been around for a long time, like Senator Rosen and Representative Murphy, Representative Thiessen, to see, you know, how maybe we should be looking at these a little bit more than we have. And she's holding hers. Is this C6, uniformity and equal benefit treatment among plans, or what would this be considered? So I have multiple questions here. And we can...
Ms. Lincheski.
You know, there actually is a provision in our principles. It's number 20 of Part C that addresses future pension coverage for privatized public employees, mm-hmm. Senator Pappas. And I think what it provides there is that, I'll just read the sentence, I think that's most relevant. Privatized public employees should receive adequate replacement pension coverage, and a better resolution of this topic should be raised with appropriate federal government officials. The second half of that, I have very little understanding of how we would really approach federal government officials with this, but I think the first part is relevant, mm-hmm. which is to say privatized public employees should receive adequate replacement pension coverage. So the question is, I think, have they received adequate replacement coverage? In this case, and that's a question, I think, for the commission in evaluating, I suppose, the entire package of augmentation here, and then in this case where augmentation is reduced from 5.5% to 2% when someone returns to public service, albeit for a short period of time. But I think that is the question for the commission, you know, is this adequate?
Senator Pappas, follow-up. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And this is for Ms. Lincheski, too, I think. So can you just walk through exactly the practical impact? Because we hear that the person is losing a pension benefit, or are they losing – I mean, is their pension benefit going down because they became a substitute teacher, or is it just that they're not earning the same augmentation?
Representative Thiessen, I wonder if that question – and Ms. Lincheski, I will defer to you since it was asked to you, but maybe be better answered by – Mr. Bergstrom, the executive director from MSRS. So, Mr. Mm-hmm. Bergstrom, if you want to come forward and attempt the question that Representative Thiessen posed to the commission tonight. Good evening, sir, and welcome to the commission. State your name for the record and proceed.
Yep, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. And if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, we had a proposal to slow the growth of benefits to the Fairview employees, and this was actually part of the package that didn't get a lot of discussion. And to give you an example, the way this works, and in this case is an extreme. So let's say the person through the Fairview is eligible for $2,000 a month. Then if he returns to any public service, so that's projected to age 65. So at age 65, we're telling them on their statement, oh, you're going to get $2,000 a month. And then 10 years in, they took a job teaching. Immediately, we stop giving them the higher augmentation, and now their benefit is maybe $1,000 a month. In this case, the person didn't even vest with teachers, so they were going to get $2,000 under the Fairview. They now, once they start contributing to TRA, they get nothing from TRA and just lost $1,000 off of their Fairview benefit.
Representative Thiessen, follow up.
What if they wouldn't have gone back to public service but would have just quit Fairview?
Mr. Chair, if they had just quit and not gone back to public service, they would have gotten the $2,000. And that, so what this seems like is a disincentive to go back to any public service. Uh-huh. And quite frankly, we have about 80, so we look back, we have about 80 active employees and about 20 retired. And almost most of them had very, very short service. Mm-hmm. And so, in essence, they are getting penalized for going back to public employment and losing monthly benefits.
Mr. Bergstrom, just for clarification for my benefit and the commission and those that are here, when you say public service, are you referring to pension-covered service where someone becomes a rink supervisor at a hockey rink for six out of the cold weeks out of winter here in Minnesota and is paid $15 an hour? Would that be qualified as public service?
Mr. Chair, that wouldn't. This would be eligible for PERA coverage or TRA coverage and MSRS coverage, and a lot of these have TRA and PERA, and we don't even know they have it until they get to retirement. And in this case, the gentleman called me, and he was quite distraught. And I mean, I can understand why, because he thought he was getting X. And even though he's getting nothing from his other pension coverage, he foregoed all of that. I don't know if foregoed is the right word. My dad's probably rolling in his grave right now because he's an English teacher, but whatever the right word
is. We won't tell him.
That's
Mr.
good, yes. So he gave up all of that augmentation.
For Wendt.
For Wendt, yes.
Representative Thiessen, follow up?
Not right now.
All right.
So, Mr. Chairman?
My next person on the list was Representative Albright, and then I will come to you, and then Representative Murphy.
Thanks.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to either the representative or the senator or Mr. Bergstrom, whomever wants to throw back at me, the point that I want to ask is this individual has it in writing that the stated benefit accruing to him was advanced augmentation. Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that is correct because their service with us is now being impacted by something that we don't even reflect. We don't even know that what TRA and PERA coverage they may have. So their statement would have shown the higher amount.
So, Mr. Chair, the presumption
Representative Albright.
Thank you, is that he relied upon the information provided to him on that statement in making decisions pursuant to participation in other plans, and without remedying that back in terms of he relied upon it in good faith, that was a correct statement made by his former employer that that is the type of benefit that he would be realizing pursuant to completion of his service and retiring. Is that correct?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Representative Driscoll, Mr. Albright, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Albright.
So then it really, in my mind anyway, doesn't matter about the eligibility because he was relying upon statements made on a statement. That's how we should move forward regardless of what's in our principles because he relied upon statements in fact in writing to him that would realize a better benefit than what he is now perceived to have being realized by coming back into public service.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Representative Driscoll, Representative Albright, that's right. We just had no way to build into our statements that other thing, that other service.
And Mr. Chair, so the point that I wanted to make
Representative Albright.
Is to the point of maybe the reliance upon principles of pension policy, as the Senator Pappas suggests, they're not meaningless, but in point of fact, is we're dealing with an error that we have to right by a participant. Is that would be the correct assumption then?
Mr. Chair, as well, I wouldn't say it was an error. We had no way of knowing, like in this case, that they returned to a substitute teacher for a few months. You know, we don't have that data necessarily. So I, to me, it's more of a policy issue. I don't look at it as our error. In a perfect world, we'd have all of the data, but we don't. So it's really a loss. It's a fact that we didn't have the data. And then it becomes somewhat of a policy issue because, in this case, for example, they lose a significant amount of benefit.
Senator Dribble, to this point, because I do have others that would like to follow up as well. To this point?
Yes. I think Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, the language in the law that covers these employees, these University of Minnesota employees whose jobs then got taken over by Fairview, as the language says, becomes covered again by a retirement plan enumerated, et cetera. So that's cell 9.1.10 of the language. And in my mind, the real question is, was in fact our constituent covered again? I mean, he went to work for a few months as a substitute teacher. He never really got covered by TFA. I mean, he was kind of touched by TFA. I don't even know what the expression is, but he was never actually covered. He also argues, for whatever it's worth, and I know ignorance of the law is no defense, but he argues that he never even knew, this was never effectively communicated to him at any point in time, that there was a penalty for returning to public service. And then, you know, I'll add again that he was, of course, projecting what his retirement income would be based on the statements that he was receiving from MSRS and making decisions about his employment and his future and his education. You know, he went on and got graduate-level education based on some of these assumptions because he had some ability to do that based on what he projected his retirement income would be. Senator Pappas, what did I say?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just didn't get an answer from Mr. Bergstrom about his position on this.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we think this would be a fair resolution, you know, because I don't think it's an error. I think it's just part of the bill turned out to be relatively fairly punitive to people who, in the most case, are very short service. In this case, they were eligible for teachers' retirement for a few months of service, but they never qualified for a benefit. So we're supportive of this. It was included in our initial package.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bergstrom, do you have an idea of the cost?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, a little hard to find out because you'd have to go through each one, but I'm guessing it's in the neighborhood of $2 to $5 million. If you remember, the package we had originally was going to lower our liabilities by about $58 million. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, our actuary, this is a foregoing of a gain again, because our actuary assumes, like in this case, the actuary is assuming all along that this person was going to be eligible for the full benefit, and now all of a sudden we come in and, oh, sorry.
Right.
So, but roughly, if I looked at the cost, it would be in the $2 to $5 million range.
Right.
And it affects about 80 active employees and 20 retirees.
And not your one constituent.
Not the one, no. So the proposal...
Mr. Bergstrom.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas. The proposal really deals with this for everybody. It's not a constituent issue. It's trying to factor all of them who fall into similar situations.
Members, in the way of background, this did start out as a single issue, and then Mr. Bergstrom started looking into it. We do have an A1 amendment tonight to look at that would cover, if I believe I've understood you right, Mr. Bergstrom, about 80 persons.
So the bill, the current bill covers about 80. 20 of those are retired, and this would take care of all of the retired folks by making the adjustment in benefit, if indeed it is needed, just prospectively.
Mr. Bergstrom, I heard you interrupt. Yep. Please continue.
Yep. So, Mr. Chair, this one, so in the bill, we have a retroactive date for that one person. And then Ms. Lincheski said, well, are we going to keep hearing from these people? And you probably would. And so this just takes care of anybody who's already retired. We would make the adjustment. We wouldn't go back and recalculate. We would just do it going forward.
And Senator Pappas, final follow-up? Or we're not taking the amendment. I'm just raising that as an issue because I see us coming down the pike asking that question. Senator Pappas.
I would really like to think a little bit more about this prospective future versus retroactive. You know, if I had a sense of how many people for how long have been getting $1,000 a month when they were supposed to be getting $2,000 a month, you know, and just because they didn't know to talk to their legislator, they don't benefit from it until this one person finally came forward. So I'd like to think about that a little bit more, and maybe if we had a little more information about the cost of that. And then I wanted to know from Mr. Bergstrom, was this proposal on your part of your whole package? Or, I mean, it was, but can this go forward on its own if we don't act on the rest of the augmentation package, which I'm not sure if we're going to or not?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I think it can. You know, this is a separate issue that was identified, and you know, it would deal with one set of problems.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
I'm not sure I completely understand, Mr. Chair, but It seems to me that until I don't understand why we could deal with it separately from the whole.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it can be separated out. I mean, this group is identifiable and...
This 80, group of 80?
Yes.
Okay. And...
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, is there notification of... Was there notification in writing to the people that were sent the letters saying $2,000 instead of $1,000, that further employment of public service would stop the $2,000?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, when this bill first passed, we did write a letter to everybody and said, you know, here's what it is, and if you return to public service, it will stop. Now, if they return to state employment, we know that, so we can be more proactive about that. Where it's a little more difficult is if they return to teachers' retirement and PERA. I will say we didn't remind them year after year of that, but we did tell them initially in a letter that if they do return to public service.
So they did receive notification that they, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, they did receive notification that their circumstances could change.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, in 1997, we told them that.
And the initial letter that told them was 1996?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it was in 1997.
Okay, 97.
Murphy.
Okay. But, Mr. Chair, was the notification letter saying that a return to a different public service or to a public service, was that in a separate letter? Or was that in the same letter that told them their benefits?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that was a separate letter from the benefits. So we send out an annual benefit statement. And in these cases, it looks at MSRS and not at what they have with TRA and PERA. So their annual statements did not include it because we didn't know they were participating in other funds.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, in their annual benefits statement, that's their benefit that you're telling them they will receive.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct.
Then, Murphy.
And that benefit is based on the augmentation that was present in 1996.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, even if this is a separate issue, could be a separate issue for these 80 people, if I think that if we decide that this tonight, that this idea for this 80 people was accepted, then the whole issue of with the augmentation and so forth has been decided too then. And I don't think this should be decided before the big issue is decided, affecting the 700 and some people.
Representative Houston.
Thank you. So just, I don't know that this, so I guess building on Representative Murphy's point, so the people in MSRS that got accurate statements, are they going to now go up to the old amount?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Under this law? So people that knew that they're getting a lower amount are now going to get the higher amount.
Mr. Chair, Representative Houston, if that, they would, yes.
And Mr. Chair, the thing I don't quite understand still, and this has maybe to do with the augmentation, is so the way that the law is interpreted here is you are getting an augmentation of 5 or 3.5%, whatever, 5.5%,
right,
while you're active at Fairview. And then you quit, but in this case, you would have quit like 5 years before you'd be eligible to actually collect your pension. Is the drop in, but you go into this public service, then that looks retrospective, and so you're dropped down to the 2%?
It just goes, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bergstrom,
going forward, it drops down to the 2%.
So even when you retire from, so any public employee, so, or an employee that retires from Fairview 5 years early, for those 5 years, they get the 3.5, the 5.5% instead of the 7.5. So when you retire, you still get the augmentation for those 5 years, and that's the difference here. All right, I'm answering my own question. Although it seems weird that you're collecting an augmentation when you've already retired, but that's a whole different question.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, you don't get augmentation once you retire. You only get it up until you retire. So in this case,
Representative Thiessen, this is one of the reasons why we have the bigger bill that
right.
we heard.
Well,
and
that would just drop it down. That would just drop the augmentation down. I mean, that's different. This is maybe. Do you understand my confusion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Ms. Lynchess, and members, given being respectful of people who have come from many parts of the state tonight who are here with their constituents and do have to travel back to their respective homes, I would like to get a flavor for what the commission would like to do. I'm okay with laying this over. If we take a vote on it tonight, it does not sound like it's going to be very successful, but if there is information that the commission needs in order to make an informed decision that we don't already have tonight, I'm open to laying that over. But Representative Thiessen, to Ms. Lynchess, with your question.
Okay, thank you very much. So just with regard to augmentation, it's like a post-retirement adjustment or COLA, except for that it applies after you terminate employment but before you start your retirement benefits. So for that stretch, these individuals are getting 5.5% additional every single year.
Even though they're not working.
Correct, yes. So the extent of the penalty in this case, just to be clear, we keep using the term penalty, is to go from 5.5% to 2% on a prospective basis. Okay? That's the penalty we're talking about.
In the Bergstrom bill.
In
the big bill.
With regard to the return to public service. So we're talking about the exception for returning to public service. This particular bill, that's correct.
To go through the chair, please.
Sorry about that. Yes, sorry about that.
Ms. Lynchowski.
Yeah, it applies in this case with this bill. Yeah, sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I have a short question.
Senator Johnson, you haven't asked a thing tonight. You take as much time as you need.
I'm trying to clarify it for myself. So if these 80 people start getting 2,000 instead of 1,000 now, and correct me if I'm saying it wrong, And then if they found out that they had only worked 9 months in a public service job, would they be able to come back in and get the same treatment, this person that we're dealing with tonight, the one person, would they be able to come in and get that same action?
I think I'm going to defer that to Mr. Bergstrom. I'm going to put a qualifier in there. There is a minimum amount of service to be eligible for pension, which I do believe is longer than 9 months, but I think we get the gist of where you're going, Senator Johnson. Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, this bill would apply to all of the Fairview employees in this case. It is not an individual bill. So in the example you put of somebody who had 9 months of service, they would not be vested, and they would not be, then they wouldn't be hurt by this because their monthly benefit is zero. So they would get exactly what they were promised. Under current law, that person would stop getting that higher augmentation the day they returned to public service. And that's so, but this bill is not a one-person bill. It affects all of the people at Fairview.
Members, Senator Dibble, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to express my preference that this be laid over, not necessarily because a vote on it would fail tonight, which it may well, but because I don't completely understand it. And also, I think we should give folks the opportunity to who are affected, the opportunity to know about this and understand it themselves.
And to your point, Senator Dibble, and to the way the general conversation is going, I don't believe there would be much success if people are pressed on a vote tonight. I'm willing to lay it over. But remember, members, we are very much up against the deadline. We have 7 weeks left of session at this point, and a lot of work and a lot of lifting that needs to be done on this bill as well as others. And so if there isn't any other discussion, I'm willing to table this, lay this bill on the table, and any of the accompanying amendments to be taken up at a future point in time to be determined, because we may not have the information necessary to be able to take it up at the next meeting. But we will work with staff and Mr. Bergstrom and others to do that. So with that, we are going to move on a little out of order here tonight. Because we do have folks who are here tonight, members of the legislature with constituents, and the item that I have is pretty much an issue that I think could be handled where it wouldn't affect people from have come from long distances. And so what I'm going to ask is, Representative Daniels, I'm going to have you come down first with your folks, and we will then proceed with the others as I see the members here in the audience. I see Representative Tice here. I think we'll take you next. And I see Representative Zerwas, and I do not see Representative Knobloch, but he does have some time to get here to bring his matter before us as well. So with that, as Representative Daniels makes his way to the testifying table, I'm going to ask Ms. Barth to background us a little bit on the issue of House File 1919 and Senate File 1972. Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, is this
Senator Pappas.
Number six tab?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry. It is number six tab. Thank you for the clarification.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a special bill that will permit 5 current state employees to purchase service credit from MSRS General for the 2 months that they were correction counselor trainees. The bill requires that the employees pay the member contributions they would have made in 1989, plus interest, and the Department of Corrections will be required to pay the balance of the full actuarial value of that benefit. And if all of these contributions are paid, each individual's start date will move from August 1989, when they gained full employment with the Department of Corrections, to June 1989, when they started as trainees, which will make them eligible for the Rule of 90. And this is an issue that has been appealed to the MSRS Executive Director, the MSRS Board of Directors, and then the Minnesota Court of Appeals, who have all ruled that these trainees were not eligible to buy this 2 months of service credit. So that's sort of the background of the situation.
Ms. Barth, thank you for that. Representative Daniels, I'll go ahead and let you kind of introduce and give us some background. And I see you have a testifier here this evening. And if my notes are right, you are Ms. Halverson.
Correct.
We will hear from you as soon as we're done with with Representative Daniels to share your thoughts with the commission. Representative Daniels, welcome to the commission. State your name for the record and proceed, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Brian Daniels from District 24B. And last year, probably about this time, I had 5 people come to me and asked if I would help them proceed in this venture to see if they can qualify for the Rule of 90. And they've done their due diligence, and they've gone forward as far as they can go. We still feel that they may be eligible if they pay some of the dues they would normally paid to qualify for that. So that's why we're here tonight, is just to see if there's anything else we can do for these 5 individuals. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to testify for Kathy Halverson to state her background.
Ms. Halverson, before I get to your testimony, members, just in the way of the history that we've started this session, items 5, 6, 7, and 8 are all what I consider to be constituent correction issues. And what we've done last meeting is we've heard those, we've laid them over for possible inclusion, and then there will be some others that are coming up in the near future as well. And as we've done in the past, we'll just take those one evening and kind of walk through and decide which ones we want to include. So there will be no action on this tonight, but the commission will take testimony. So with that, Ms. Halverson, welcome to the Pension Commission, and if you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony for consideration by the Commission.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Catherine Halverson, and thank you again for allowing me to be here tonight. There were 5 of us to begin with. We started in an academy in June of 1989 for the Department of Corrections as corrections counselors. We actually are down to 4 members that are still without the benefit of Rule of 90. We started in the correctional officer plan, so we did not start in the general plan because we started off as correctional counselors in three of the facilities across the state. I started at the Shakopee Women's Prison. Two of our staff are on this docket, started at Stillwater and two at Oak Park Heights. During our hire time, separately and individually, we were informed how fortunate we were to have started in June of 1989 because we had the additional benefit possibility of Rule of 90. We were in the correctional plan at the time, so we already had that benefit of early retirement if we stayed in the officer ranks. The reason it was brought to our attention was because very often in the Department of Corrections, people leave the correctional officer ranks for promotional opportunities or different career paths in the department. So throughout our career, we did rely on the fact that we had Rule of 90 in the back of our retirement benefit. In about the year 2000, my story, I was facing layoff from the Department of Corrections as a corrections lieutenant. In lieu of layoff, I was offered to accept a demotion. In talking with the HR staff during that process, I said, well, if I have leave the early retirement correctional officer plan, SERP, as a lieutenant and go into a different position that's not covered under SERP, would I still have Rule of 90 opportunity? And the answer was that I would. So I made choices in my career based on some of that information that I was receiving. Took a demotion and went out of the SERP plan to a non-officer position and then continued my career with the plan that I had this opportunity of Rule of 90. And within the last about 3 years was contacted by one of the people in my academy that I started with who had discovered in a conversation with MSRS that he was not eligible for Rule of 90. And again, we started in the academy together as officers. So then I looked into it again with MSRS and at that time was told that I was not included in Rule 90 because we were correctional trainees. And there's a training period for correctional officers. So several people are hired into an academy. Some are officers, some are maintenance, some are teachers. And so you go off onto your different job, and the correctional officers have a longer period of training. And so some people who started in our academy are included in Rule of 90 because they weren't officers, and they started in June of 1989 and maybe went into their positions before July 1st of 1989 because they didn't go through the entire officer academy. So as I said, as I continued to work through my career and move up in out of the officer ranks, but move up in the department into management level of the Department of Corrections, thinking I had Rule of 90 up until the last couple of years. And so that's when we started this process of looking into certainly the different information we were given by different people throughout our careers. Initially, in 1989, when I knew I had early retirement, I didn't ask the question of put it in writing. I didn't ask anybody to put the Rule of 90 information in writing for me because at that time I was 23 years old and thought that I was going to be a corrections officer for long into my future. And so what we are asking for is the ability to buy back, as you stated, the time that we started in June of 1989, our service with the Department of Corrections.
Ms. Helverson, thank you for your testimony. Before I ask for member questions, I also have a Mr. Moser on the list. Is he also here this evening? And I suspect that the commission would like to hear from him as well, since it's on the same topic, and then we'll see if there are questions this evening from members of the commission. Mr. Moser, welcome to the Pension Commission. I'm going to ask you to state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony before the commission.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kevin Moser.
And if you'd like to go ahead and share your anything you can add to the discussion, that would be helpful for the commission to consider the situation and matter before us that affects you and others.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. The story is a little bit different for each one of us. The trainee period during that era was different at each facility. Like Catherine has explained, the training period was about 3 weeks at Shakopee. I think it was 6 weeks at Stillwater, and it was 9 weeks at Oak Park Heights, where I had started. Had a number of people that did share with us how fortunate we were when we started. That included Warden Frank Wood, HR personnel Leanne Finney, training directors Otis Sanders and Doug Applegren, that shared with us not only as an individual groups. So we were pretty well informed that and felt fortunate that we did fall before the deadline of July 1st of 1989. Career decisions were made about promotion opportunities outside the early retirement that were taken by several of us along that path. And as it came up, I was in that plan up until 2008 when I made the decision to move into management and DHS. Through that process and working with Mr. Bergstrom, it became more apparent that we were not considered because we did not contribute to the retirement during our 9 weeks, 3 weeks, or 6 weeks. And what we are asking for is consideration that if, because we were, our hire dates still go back to 6-7 of 89, our seniority dates go back to 6-7 of 89, our pension reflects 6-7 of 89, and what we're asking is that opportunity to buy back that 9 weeks, 6 weeks, or 3 weeks, depending upon where you started your career in corrections. In those days, you did your first week at the facility, and then you went up to SOC Center for 3 weeks of training. Then you went back to your home facility and finished your training there. The training included on-the-job training, which was about 65% of the time, and about 35% in the classroom. We performed tasks much like in an on-a-job training program. It wasn't as formal back in those days as it is today. We performed the jobs and the tasks, and we've testified to this with the appeals panel, that we conducted the same tasks and duties as the correctional officers that were vested in paying into the pension. We also were present to the same client or offender behavior that we were exposed to and dealt with. We wrote incident reports during those 9 weeks. We did facility counts for offender population, conducted unclothed body searches, and conducted all the same duties underneath the supervision of veteran staff. But nevertheless, we're in a training program at that time. And I guess I'm open for any questions at this point. Just that opportunity to buy back those 6, 3, or 9 weeks to make the opportunity to be eligible for the Rule of 90.
Members, questions for the two testifiers, or we will also be inviting Mr. Bergstrom to come up and to do some background on this as well, since it is MSRS coverage and it is our custom to hear from the plans as well. Questions for the testifiers at this time?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question actually for Ms. Barth or maybe Mr. Bergstrom, who's been around a little longer, is, we don't have the Rule of 90 anymore, do we? And when did we eliminate it, you know?
Ms. Barth.
No, we do not have the Rule of 90 anymore, and that was eliminated in 1989. And the cutoff is you had to be hired before July 1st, 1989.
But if you were hired after that, then Senator you Pappas. Weren't eligible at all for the Rule of 90.
That's correct.
Other questions at this time for the two testifiers? We're going to ask you to stay close by, because you may be asked some questions. At this time, Mr. Bergstrom, I'm going to ask you to come forward from the plan and help again to continue backgrounding for the commission. Mr. Bergstrom, welcome back again, sir. State your name for the record, and then share your research or your information with the commission as we ponder this.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. So to be eligible for the Rule of 90, you had to be a member prior to July 1 of 1989. Trainees are not members until they finish the training program. So this group did not have any pension coverage before 1989. I want to make it clear that MSRS did not tell them they were the last class to be under the Rule of 90. That allegedly was told by someone in the department. So MSRS did not tell them they were eligible for the Rule of 90. The board actually heard their appeal about a year, a little over a year ago. They took this case to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals affirmed our decision. This has two precedent issues for me. One is eligibility for the Rule of 90. They were trainees, not eligible. We, as we've talked before, we have a lot of employees in similar, not exactly this, but in situations where they were not eligible. And then, so they weren't a member and later became a member. So that is a concern. The second precedent is just within DOC. DOC has routinely not covered correctional plan trainees. So why this group qualifies for the Rule of 90, we have 20, 30 years of DOC trainees who didn't get 2 months of service credit because they were in a training program. And today, they're still not getting that service credit, is my understanding. And so that group, I think, could clearly make the same claim. The cost of this for the four individuals affected for the department would be in the neighborhood of $625,000. And under the bill, the department would be required to pay. So we're opposed to the bill. We've heard this bill. They've been to the board. We've been to the Court of Appeals. And they did not qualify. And I've seen no evidence that MSRS ever said they were eligible for the bill.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. I think I was going to ask that question about how much it would cost the department. I also want to know how much I see here on this memo we have that that there's an actuarial cost to MSRS for providing Rule 90 to the five employees will be a very large cost. Could you tell me what that is,
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, the cost, so the bill, this bill, MSRS would actually not lose under this because the department would have to pay the full actuarial cost. And that full actuarial cost is $625,000. And there are only four individuals because one of them we did find was actually a member of another public pension plan and already met the through other employment and they did qualify. So for the four individuals, it's a total of $625,000.
And then the other.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much would the employees have to pay and how much would they gain by going back?
Mr. Bergstrom.
2 months.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, roughly it varies a little bit between the employees, but it's about $1,000. One of the individuals' benefit would go from $3,709 to $5,570. Another individual would go from $4,370 to $6,131. Another benefit would go to would go from $7,304 to $8,440 a month. And the last individual would go from $2,819 to
$4,088.
And Mr.
Senator Goodwin.
I'll quickly sum it up here. Mr. Chair, and the this would set a new precedent as well, correct?
Mr. Bergstrom. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I believe it would.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
My questions were answered. Thank you.
Members, other questions for Mr. Bergstrom or the testifiers? And again, finally, is there anyone else here this evening that would like to speak to the matter before the commission from the public? Seeing no one, again, as I said, we'll be laying this over for possible inclusion. We do not take action on these until our final evening when we're putting the bill together, as we do get these kinds of requests periodically throughout the session and just deal with them all in one topic item at the end of the final meeting of the commission. We put our final omnibus bill together. Ms. Halverson, final statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What Mr. Bergstrom said about the monetary amounts, the other impact is the date in which we would be eligible to retire. So the length of service is the impact besides the monetary.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one final question for you. You knew you weren't paying into the retirement fund those 2 months of your training or those however many weeks it was of your training. You knew that you weren't at that point. You were getting paid, but you weren't paying into the retirement fund.
Ms. Halverson.
Mr. Chair, at quite honestly at that time, just out of college, starting as a corrections counselor for the Department of Corrections, we made $4.35 an hour. And so I was thankful to get a paycheck, and I couldn't tell you honestly that I looked to see that I had a retirement benefit coming out.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you for being with us tonight, Mr. Moser and Ms. Halverson. With that, we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the 2016 pension bill. Representative Zerwas, I know they are waiting for you over in committee as well. So, sir, we're going to bring you and your constituent up right now to be able to take that. And then Representative Tice, you will be on deck with yours shortly after Representative Zerwas and his constituent have a chance to visit with the commission. Members, this is number five on our agenda this evening, and members of the public, number five. Representative Zerwas, welcome to the commission. If you will state your name for the record, and then we'll get a chance to get some backgrounding on this from Ms. Barth as well. Representative Zerwas.
Representative Nick Zerwas, representing House District 30A.
And Ms. Barth, if you'd like to give us some background.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill will allow Mr. Lawrence Barber to rescind his decision to receive a retirement annuity he began receiving on January 1st, 2009, and instead receive a duty disability benefit from PARA's police and fire retirement plan, and that will be effective retroactively January 1st, 2009. And then in order to receive that duty disability benefit, Mr. Barber must present evidence to the PARA executive director that demonstrates he would have been entitled to receive a duty disability benefit if he had applied, and that he was not aware of his entitlement to receive such a benefit due to a medical misdiagnosis. In order to receive a duty disability, a member must provide evidence that the disability occurred while on the job and that the disability is preventing them from performing the normal employment duties of that job. And then if an individual does receive a duty disability benefit, one of the additional benefits will be under Chapter 299A, which requires the employer, which in this case is the city of Fridley, to pay for the individuals and any dependents' health care costs until the individual reaches age 65.
Thank you, Ms. Barth. With that, again, Representative Zerwas, we are going to hear testimony, and then we'll lay it over, as we've mentioned earlier, just for clarification on that. And I see that you have your constituent here this evening. We'll ask you to go ahead and background it, and then we'll hear from him. And we do have a couple of other individuals from the city of Fridley who would like to share some backgrounding with the commission as well. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing my bill today. It's my first time in front of the Pension Commission. I've known Mr. Farber for many, many years. Actually, prior to working for Fridley Police Department, Larry Farber was hired by my dad to work for the Elk River Police Department. Later on in life, I had the pleasure of serving on the city council with Larry, and then he went on to serve as a Sherburne County commissioner. During the course of his duties, he was called to a medical where a woman collapsed while calling 911, going into cardiac arrest. He arrived at the house. The house was secured, and he used his shoulder in an attempt to knock down the door to get access to that distressed woman. They ended up getting access to the distressed woman, providing CPR and life-saving measures, and she survived that medical emergency. During that incident, Mr. Farber had severe injury, at first believed to his shoulder, received treatment and surgery on his shoulder. Despite that treatment and surgery, that never went away. And shortly after retired, things escalated pretty quickly with routine injections into his shoulder, where finally, down the line, after a few shoulder surgeries were not successful with Mr. Farber's injury, they did a scan on his neck, identifying that he had several compressed discs in his neck that the doctor put back to that incident where he was able to break through a door in that life-saving measure. He's since had several neck surgeries, as well as seven surgeries in all, I believe, and still lives in pain. And he can detail his story a little bit, but I'd like to make note that as we talk about this, this is an individual that, while responding to 911, sustained a life-altering, life-changing injury that's impacted him a decade later and prevented him from working fully. And I'll let Mr. Farber testify briefly and fill in the pieces that I may have missed.
Good evening, Mr. Farber. Welcome to the Pension Commission. If you'll state your name for the record and then background us on your situation. Welcome.
My name is Lawrence Farber. Thank you for hearing my testimony. Nick did a very good job of backgrounding on that. I did have two surgeries while I was still working for the city of Fridley. I retired shortly after. It was January 1, 2009. And I believe my shoulder was fine. As it went on, I ended up having cortisone shots, as many as I could. And by the summer of 2010, I had another MRI. The pain was so bad that my hands were going numb. And the doctor wasn't sure why. They did MRIs of my bicep, my arm, and my shoulder again. Finally, they did an MRI of my neck, and the doctor referred me to a neck specialist who determined that it was related. The League of Minnesota Cities, the City of Fridley, signed off. I had the surgery. Unfortunately, it didn't heal. So a year later, they went back in through the front of my neck, and they did another surgery. A year later, the pain was getting quite bad again, and they determined that I hadn't healed again. So they put a bone stimulator on me, and 6 months later, they did an X-ray, and they determined that from what he could see, it had healed. A month later, after giving me the permission to do anything I needed to do, no restrictions, I was back with more pain, and they did a CAT scan, and I had not healed, and actually the screws had come loose and were moving. So a request for the surgery was put in. The league and the city of Fridley, they didn't want to pay for a fifth surgery. We had several doctors, one of theirs, one of mine, look into things. Finally, it was resolved that I could have the surgery. It was PERC related. I had the surgery, and it has healed. But during the surgery, I ended up having a heart attack and had bypass surgery after that and some stints after that. That didn't heal properly. During the whole course of this, I had to hire an attorney because Workman's Comp, they're very slow at trying to get things done. And finally, we came to a stipulated agreement through Workman's Comp that I am permanently disabled and cannot work. And I have copies of that here. It's signed off by myself, I believe the City of Fridley and the League of Minnesota Cities. So, what I'm asking for is, I called Kara after my first surgery, and they told me I didn't have any options. I had retired, and it doesn't matter if it was misdiagnosed or not. I didn't have any avenues to go through. I called them about a half a dozen times, seeing if things had changed. I had different people try and contact the leader, the head of PERA, and people who were in the know, and I was told there was no appeals process. It was too late, and they have a very strict standard. Once you retire, once you choose the way you retire, that's the way it is. So I contacted Representative Zerwas. We've been working on this for about 3 years, and the only remedy we can come up with is what I'm asking you today is I am medically disabled from this injury, and because PERA has no real appeals process, I can't get the benefits that I'm entitled to, and I'm asking this committee to look, to.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Farber, thank you for your testimony. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see by the memo we get from our staff here that you reached a settlement with the City of Fridley for workers' compensation on August 1st, 2015.
Right.
So you must have settled and gotten compensation at that point.
Mr. Farber.
Is that correct?
For workers' comp.
Yes, for workers' comp. Yes. And then...
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. This would be a bill that would set another precedent, and we may have to go back and look at other cases that are similar. This would bring your disability benefit back to
the date of your retirement from Fridley, so it would be January 1st, 2009.
Correct.
And then you would be receiving health care benefits during, I mean, from, besides what you've already received from the city of Fridley. I just, looking at this, in that the city of Fridley would have to go back, would have to pay at least $200,000 for this bill. So, and then let me just clarify that you did go to, you didn't leave your job at City of Fridley for the, because of the injury. You left because you were eligible to retire. So actually their records show that you didn't, you left because you were able to retire, not because of your injury. Is that correct?
Mr. Faber.
That's correct. Okay, thank you. And then the final question I have, Mr. Chair, is let's see here, that the medical misdiagnosis is what you're saying for kind of the reason of thinking that this should be go back. Okay. Now, when you received your treatment through for your first shoulder injury, that was through a physician of your own choice, or that was through somebody that the city said you had to see?
Mr. Faber.
My own choice.
Thank you. Okay, that's all.
Other questions for the testifier or Representative Zerwas? We do have two individuals from the city of Fridley that would like to testify this evening, Ms. Dahl and Ms. Scogan. If they are here, we certainly would like to hear from you as we contemplate this matter as well.
Mr. Chairman, while they're coming up.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, is there any additional, in this legislation, is anything required from PERA, or does it just have to do with the City of Fridley?
Yeah, you have raised the next question that I was going to take to City of Fridley, and I was going to invite PERA,
okay,
Police and Fire, to come up and to provide some background for the, so the Commission has the whole picture to be able to render that decision. Good evening and welcome this evening, ladies, to the Commission. And I will ask you to go individually, and I'm going to ask whoever is going to testify first to identify themselves for the record and then proceed with your testimony. And then when the first is done, we'll go to the second. So with that, the coin toss went to... All right. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Debbie Dahl. I'm the Human Resources Director for the City of Fridley. I have Deb Scogan here, who is here in support and also has been helping me with this. She's our city clerk as well. Thank you, Chair and members. This is we appreciate the opportunity to testify. This is certainly a difficult and somewhat complex situation, so we appreciate the time and certainly sympathize with Mr. Farber as well in this difficult situation. He's been a very good employee for over 24 years, and so we would like to recognize that as well. So I believe that you have all received a letter from the City of Fridley that our city manager prepared and distributed. I apologize. We really were caught off guard with this matter, and so got this to you as a late notice, so we appreciate that. I'll go through pieces of this. I won't read all of the items, but I certainly have a few comments to emphasize. So the parties financially impacted where this were certainly caught off guard. Alternatives to legislation, we understand, have not been reached, and that is pursuing PERA and determining a disability through PERA. So I think PERA is here to talk about that if there's a question with that, as well as the League of Minnesota Cities and FIN. The real bottom line here is a hardship for the city of Fridley in upwards of $200,000 to possibly $400,000, depending on the coverage, health coverage that the former employee had. So that's certainly our concern, as well as a precedent that could possibly be set for other members down the road. So certainly we would like an opportunity to appeal this if it were determined through PERA, and so by this group acting on this legislation, it really takes us kind of out of the loop of any appeal process. So we'd like that opportunity if and when it does go to PERA. So the individual's claim of medical misdiagnosis is really certainly not timely, given his retirement happened sooner, but it's really unclear to the city, and we're not sure the position on that and really can't comment on that one. Certainly we feel that it could be better legislated through the PERA opportunity rather than this body, but we certainly understand the position. And again, the potential for other cities is really an issue, I think, that the League of Minnesota Cities has had, and we've had conversations with them. We're not disputing the injury. We certainly understand it was a very difficult situation, and we appreciate it was a long and lengthy workers' compensation claim and settlement with several matters. I'm not really prepared to talk about that. I'm not certainly at liberty with a lot of the information, and we'll have to leave that for this group to decide. Certainly, Mr. Farber's avenue to para, we think, is a better alternative to determine a disability and if the medical misdiagnosis occurred. We believe Mr. Farber was totally able to perform the duties of his position and in 2008 when he left, and it certainly was a delay in dealing with any follow-up surgeries or medical issues later on that resulted from that serious injury. So it's our position. He resigned with a standard retirement. There was no communication with the city about, from what I understand, of any continued problems. So I'd also say that even though Mr. Farber went on, this bill would allow him to collect insurance under the 299A chapter, which would go back to his date of employment or a separation of employment, which was January 1st of 2009, and require the city to pay for insurance that he might have already been paying for insurance through another employer after leaving us. So there would be a double duty, or I should say a double duplicate benefit that he would have received as well. And this is seriously a financial hardship for the city of Fridley, in upwards of $200,000 to possibly $400,000, which for the city of Fridley is a very large amount. We have more complicated issues at the city where we're facing a levy restriction that doesn't allow the city to tax its residents more than 5% or whatever the cost of living index is, whichever is less. And so for this next year, we're looking at a 0% increase for the following budget. So this $200,000 or more would come directly out of the bottom line of the city of Fridley, which is simply too difficult to afford. So I'll also just comment that we do think that this will invite other employees, not necessarily from the city of Fridley, but from other cities that might give them pause on a situation similar to this and also want to come forward, which would expose taxpayers across the board for additional costs. So I think that's all I had to offer. I thank you for the opportunity. This is certainly an important matter, and we're certainly very sensitive to the injuries that Mr. Farber sustained, and felt that we treated him well throughout the process in his workers' comp case, and eventually came to terms with a good settlement under the workers' comp rules, and did a fair job with that as well. So I'll take any questions if there
are. Ms. Dahl, thank you for your testimony this evening. We do have one question, but I also want to go to the second testifier. Ms. Scogan, is there anything else that we haven't heard that you'd like to add at this point before we do open it to member questions?
Yes, what I would just like to add is, you know, we understand that there is state has set aside appropriations to help with the health care benefit if somebody has received the duty disability. So the only thing we would ask, if you decide to move this forward, is that you think about some type of appropriation that could possibly help the city with the, if it were to go retroactive, which we don't believe it should go retroactive, if this did happen to the individual, if it was retroactive, we could not go back and get those funds. So that would be the only thinking that I would like to include.
Thank you both for your testimony. And Representative Kreisha, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My quick question, and just because I don't understand it, if we were to have a favorable decision by this committee, would we then trump that settlement? Is that what would essentially happen, or would that be in addition to the settlement?
Ms. Barth.
Representative Kreisha, I know very little about workers' comp, but I don't think it trumps it. I think it offsets it.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah. Representative Kreisha, follow up?
And just for clarity, so would it be an addition then? So I'm assuming we would be supplementing it.
That's my understanding, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Dahl.
No, this is a separate matter from the workers' comp settlement. That is a total separate matter, so it has little to do with anything that's already been settled. This is a separate matter involving para and retirement benefits, as well as a health insurance coverage that the city would have to reimburse him for directly. So a separate matter.
Representative Kreshaw.
And thank you. So thank you for that. And so is that also something that could be handled through the court system as opposed to, or does this have to come through the pensions? I'm just trying to understand the recourse.
Ms. Barr.
Representative Kreshaw, you mean this particular situation with PARA?
Yeah.
So PARA does have an appeals process that we believe is there to be used, and this has not gone through that process yet. So there is an appeals process if Mr. Farber wanted to take advantage of that.
Thank you very much.
Senator Pappas and Representative Albright.
Mr. Chairman, I read the last paragraph in the memo, and it answered my question.
Excellent. Representative Albright, did you also happen to find your answer your question when you were reading the memo as well?
No.
Okay. Well, we thought we'd give you a chance.
I have a question for Mr. Farber.
Mr. Farber, if you'll just return to the testifying table, again state your name, and then Representative Albright will present his question.
Lawrence Farber.
Mr. Farber, thank you for your service to your community.
Thank you.
And I certainly empathize with your circumstances. I'm looking at the document that you shared with us, was provided by Representative Zerwas from the state of Minnesota work comp section. And in under section 4, under consideration, it states that both parties agree to make, and the employee hereby stipulates the employee is permanently and totally disabled from the effects of his work-related injury as of 1 October 2006. Is that correct?
Mr. Farber.
That was the date of injury, correct?
Okay.
Representative Albright, follow-up?
No, I think I've got it now.
Okay. Are there any other member questions at this point? Because we do want to give Ms. Jones and the representatives from PERA an opportunity to help us learn some more information as we deliberate what to do. Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but I just have a comment on our principles here. Under number 11 in our principles, it says, say that, you know, deadline extensions or waivers should not be permitted unless there's sufficient suitable basis for the extension, and it does not involve broader applicability than the pension plan member making the request. And that in another part, it talks about how we should make sure that the costs are covered. So I'm hoping, as the representative of the city of Fridley, that if we do, if this is somehow approved, that the city covered, the costs of the city get covered by the legislature, by the state.
Senator Goodwin, thank you. If you gentlemen will stand by, we'll bring up Ms. Jones from the PERA Police and Fire. Ask you to identify yourself for the record and provide us any additional information from PERA's perspective that we would need as we're deliberating what to do with the matter before us.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Shana Jones, Policy Director at PERA. Mr. Farber, under the provisions being suggested, would be able to submit to PERA evidence that he was disabled at the time that he was a public employee. So skip past that and assume that he meets all of that criteria. The benefit would be increased, and there's a present value cost to doing so. It's over $50,000. For the last 7 years, our actuary has assumed that he's a retired member, and the cost to providing his benefit is clearly defined. In addition to that, we would see that he's underpaid about $10,000. There's an ex-spouse that's underpaid about $2,500. However, during this time that the disability benefit would be paid retroactively, he was receiving some workers' compensation benefits actually paid directly to him in 2012, along with earnings as a county commissioner, and our law requires that we offset for those earnings. So after we take all of that into account, he's really overpaid $20,000 because of that, and he would owe us $9,000 if he actually went through with this bill right now. So I'm not sure if he's aware of that.
Ms. Jones, yeah. I want to just back that statement up just a minute here. So he would or would no longer, he would then become eligible for a PERA disability benefit after he paid $9,000 for all the offsets, is what I'm hearing.
So I'm assuming the standards are met, all the criteria in the bill is met, and he's eligible for the disability benefit retroactively. He would owe us money if he decided to rescind his retirement and collect a disability. That is correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Papp.
Mr. Chairman, but I think that we wanted to know going forward, because a lot of times people owe money, but then it's a benefit to them moving forward.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas.
Ms. Jones, please continue.
The current benefit is $4,203.39. It would be $4,373. Quite honestly, it's not that large of a difference in the monthly benefit. So I'm not sure, because we haven't had the ability to have conversations about what the concern is, I'm not positive if it's really the disability benefit or if it's the Chapter 299A continued health coverage that is the concern for Mr. Farber.
And Ms. Lincheski or Ms. Barth, the 299 consideration is outside of the scope of this commission. It's only the pension-related issues that would be within the scope of this commission. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That it's not part of our retirement coverage statute. It's just something that kind of goes with the whole package of a duty disability benefit.
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, on top of that, I did want to point out that in order to meet the standard, until tonight, I didn't have much information about what the actual medical issue was. But based on Mr. Farber's own words, he believed his shoulder was fine at the time of retirement. The standard in our law that he would be subject to would require him to prove that he could not be a police officer at the time of retirement. It seems a little unlikely that that standard is to be met. And then the last point that I'd like to raise is the precedent setting of changing a decision 7 years down the road. We haven't had any other cases where someone sought to change a benefit entirely like this 7 years down the road. And so if we knew things, we could see that far into the future, we might all make different choices or want to redo choices. And so I think this is a very slippery slope to go down.
Questions for Ms. Jones. Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, in light of Ms. Jones' comments, I can't remember what was the motion on this bill. Are you just laying it over? Or what's
we are laying
the
it over possible inclusion. We're taking all of these matters tonight that are of this nature and the ones that we had last week and the ones we are anticipating having it next week, and we'll take those on our final evening when we put the omnibus together.
Okay, so no official action tonight.
No official action.
It'll give Mr. Farber a chance to absorb the $9,000 that he'd be paying in.
Tell me one more time, Representative, and I wasn't following you there.
This will give Mr. Farber the opportunity to reevaluate potentially?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Other questions for the testifier, for Representative Zerwas, for the members of the city, or for Ms. Jones? Seeing none, thank you all for your participation this evening. And Mr. Farber, Mr. Farber, is there one final comment that you'd like to make to the commission?
Yes, I would. Part of the medical pension is you get a tax benefit as well. You don't pay taxes on that money, so there is a benefit there. And I also wanted to point out, I called PERA at least a half a dozen times. Mr. Zerwas contacted them. Keith Carlson, who I think some of you might be familiar with, contacted them. There was no avenue available, no appeals, no anything on my conversations or with Mr. Yeah. Zerwas. Nothing until tonight. I heard there's an appeals process now. So I've been told nothing. I was told I had no other avenue but to come here.
Huh.
And so I'm just kind of surprised by this new information, because it's not 7 years later. I started this phone conversation 5 years ago. Mr. Zerwas has been working on this for 3 years. And there's been no avenue for appeals. And I have one other comment I'd like to make. The financial hardship for the city of Fridley. As a city councilman, I don't know where they're coming up with. I would have medical coverage for 12 years, and they're coming up with $200,000 to $400,000 for 12 years worth of health coverage. I just don't see it. I was with city government for 12 years, and I know what health costs are. And these figures are highly inflated, and I don't know why they're doing that. It's just kind of surprising.
Well, Mr. Chair.
We have 16 minutes and three more bills to take, folks, so I just want to help you budget your time a little bit here. Thank you, Mr. Faber. I think Senator Goodwin's going to get the last word on this.
Quick question. Mr. Faber, were you covered? Do you have health insurance as a county commissioner and retirement benefits?
Mr. Faber.
Out of the six years, I've had health coverage. Two of the years, I had to pay out of my pocket. So I wouldn't be opposed to working something out with the city of Fridley. I don't have a problem with that. But I did pay out of my pocket for 2 years.
And to wrap this up, remember there are a lot of things, members, that were discussed that are outside of the purview of this commission. Ours is to determine whether or not Mr. Faber would be eligible for a disability benefit and was there an error in the process in determining that. And so with that, we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you all. And with that, Representative Tice, I'm going to ask you to come forward. You've been patiently waiting with your constituents this evening to visit about this. And then we'll hear from Representative Knobloch. And these two matters, although independent, do have some related discussion to them or of the same topic. So with that, Representative Tice, welcome to the Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, before we do that, I just wanted to say I think it's troubling that an individual is told there's not an appeals process at PERA. So I think at some point it would be helpful if Ms. Jones kind of clarified why is there an appeals process or is there not an appeals process, and why would people be told repeatedly there's not one if there is one?
As 30 seconds or less.
She didn't have to do it now, but.
Well, because I want to wrap up the one set of issues and move on. Is it April 1st or something? Because it seems really kind of odd tonight with where things are going. Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I think we have to provide a little more clarity about what we're talking about when we refer to the appeals process. If he wanted to appeal to have his benefit reconsidered as a disability, no, there's not an appeals process for that. He decided it, and the law says a benefit once granted cannot be changed. If he wanted to pursue us making the determination about his eligibility for Chapter 299A coverage, that responsibility falls in our court. It is a separate process, and we believe that he has the ability without an appeal process or legislative intervention to do that, and that hasn't been done. And it sounds like that might be news to him, so we can talk offline.
And Ms. Jones, I encourage the parties that are of interest in this to get together to have those conversations, and I appreciate your clarification on that. With that, take two. Representative Tice, welcome to the commission. And with that, we will invite you to introduce yourself and your constituent. But before we do that, we are going to ask Ms. Barth to give us a little bit of background on what we're looking at this evening, and then we'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill permits an individual, Linda Dene, to purchase service credit from the PERID General Plan for the 5 years that she was erroneously placed in the MNSCU IRAP plan, which is a defined contribution plan. So a little bit of background. Ms. Dene changed positions while she was working at St. Cloud State, and through that sort of position change, she was erroneously placed in the MNSCU IRAP plan, although she had been a previous PARA member, and per MNSCU statute, she should have continued that PARA coverage. She was contributing to IRAP from February 22nd, 2006 to May 10th, 2011, when the error was discovered, and then she was put back into the PARA plan. So this is her chance to buy back those 5 years of service that she should have been in PARA.
Representative Tice, if you want to make some opening comments, and then we'll hear from your constituent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm not going to say a whole lot about this. I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Dene because of the time, but just want to say that I'm very pleased to be here today and bringing this forward since Ms. Dene and I graduated from high school together. So it's an honor to do some work for a good friend. With that, I'm just going to turn it over to Linda, and she can tell you her story.
Ms. Dene, welcome to the commission. If you would state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, for this opportunity to address the Pension Commission. I'm Linda Dene. I'm a current employee at St. Cloud State. When I transferred to St. Cloud State, I was in PERA. When I moved into the MUSAF union, I was placed in IRAP. I honestly didn't know anything different. I trusted that our HR staff thought that's where I was supposed to be. So it wasn't until I was tenured with MUSAF that I had the choice to choose between IRAP and TRA. I checked on the paperwork, TRA, which then generated a letter from them that said, welcome. And then, by the way, have you been in any other state pension plans, which I checked, PERA. And that then generated this whole process of saying I was never supposed to be an IRAP to begin with. And it kind of went from there. The Mary Munshaw from the Minsky Personnel Director had sent an email, quoted Minnesota State Statute, that because it had been about 5 years that I was in IRAP, the state statute said I could only move back if I had been on 2 years or under. And it was state statute, so I thought there was nothing I could do about it. And it wasn't until a friend suggested recently that I talk to Dr. King Banyan at St. Cloud State that he said there might be some options to actually correct this. And that's when I contacted Representative Tice.
Members, questions for Representative Tice or Ms. Dene at this point? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dene, do you have enough money in your IRA account to pay para?
Ms.
Yes.
Dene.
The numbers, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yes, the numbers that were quoted from para were my contribution would be right around $32,000. I would need to turn over my IRAP account, which has about $50,000 in it, and the total due is about $62,000. So I'm asking, I don't know, the university, I'm not sure, mm-hmm. to cover that $12,000 difference.
Senator Pappas, follow-up?
No, that's good.
Other questions for the testifier or Representative Tice? We do have two representatives from MNSCU here this evening who I think want to also provide some feedback on the matter. Or at least they're on the testifying list, and we'll give them the opportunity to share any information that the commission needs to have in order to be able to render a decision on this matter. And again, we will handle this the same way we've handled others. We'll take testimony laid over for possible inclusion. Gentlemen, welcome, and we'll ask you who won the coin toss. He did. He's pointing over here to you. So if you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'd like to point out I lost the coin toss. No, excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll keep this very brief in light of time. We simply, as representatives of MNSCU, my name is Derek Hughes. I'm the System Director for Compensation and Retirement with the MNSCU system. Want to acknowledge on behalf of St. Cloud State that we do acknowledge the error that exists, and Ms. Dene should have, in fact, remained in the the PERA plan from 2006 to 2011. Ms. Dene did note that our former personnel director, Mary Munshaw, had acknowledged a statute stating that beyond a certain limitation period, we simply move her back into PERA moving forward and do not move the existing funds over. We have since reviewed that statute and found that that statute does not apply to MNSCU defined contribution plans. Therefore, we do not find any statute, quite frankly, to manage this situation. Therefore, we do fully support this decision.
Thank you, sir. And did you have anything to add that the commission hasn't already heard?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no.
And state your name for the record, if you would.
My name is Chris Dale. I'm the Senior System Director for Labor Relations.
Thank you, sir. Members, questions? Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question for a process-oriented. I know we'll probably hold this over for possible inclusion, so our intent is to have a bill. If this were to be included, if we didn't have a bill, would this still travel? I mean, how could we make sure something like this could be rectified?
Representative Kreisha, from a procedural standpoint, this kind of matter, along with others, have been handled in an omnibus bill. Because of the nature of pension-related issues, the commission was created for the purpose of dealing with these things, to bring out an omnibus bill that would then make respective stops in the House and the Senate at the various committees. So there isn't a way for it to necessarily travel individually. It would come through this commission and then be included or not included at that point. Obviously, could, you know, things could happen in the way of amendments and different things in committees on bills or other things that would be the normal legislative process. But the short answer is, to the best of my knowledge, it needs to come through here. That's why the Pension Commission was created as such.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krusha.
And thank you. And so you mentioned something, I mean, just so the bill author knows, I mean, amendment could be a viable option for them if they wanted to choose down the road.
There is a procedure legislatively for that to happen, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions for the testifiers? Senator Pappas.
I just wanted to ask an amendment to the omnibus bill or an amendment to something else?
Senator Pappas, what I was referring to is something else that might be of the same subject matter that would be working its way through the House or the Senate. Any member could offer on the floor, at least in the House, the opportunity to amend that bill to include something. Highly unlikely, highly improbable, but there is a legislative procedure for that. That's all I'm saying. Seeing no more questions, Director Lincheski.
Hi. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I just wanted to note that Rachel and I, as you know, are learning a lot here, and we have over the last year. These individual bills that are coming forth, and particularly the ones relating to Minsky, we are hoping to work on these over the summer and bring something that is a little bit of a bill of general application so that perhaps we can avoid having these continue to come up and take up the time of the commission. So I just wanted to mention that this is something that we're now aware of. We're going to look at the fact patterns, and we're going to see if there's a way to fix it, working with these gentlemen over the summer.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krusha.
And thank you. And very quickly to that, Ms. Lincheski, is there a time stamp on this? I mean, this can be handled in, I mean, there's no hard stop, correct?
Ms. Barr.
Representative Krusha, I'm sorry, could you?
I mean, is there a deadline we have to look out for that if we pass that would cause problems?
Ms. Barr.
You mean within the bill or?
No, for this specific issue, I'm sorry.
Just for her.
For her.
I mean, I guess we'd have to do it before she retired. I guess that's kind of the hard deadline.
That's what I was just looking for. Thank you.
Well, and Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pat.
I think the longer we wait, it gets more expensive for her. I just noticed that in the memo it says $29,000 and she mentioned $32,000. So I think that would be
the price of poker is going up.
And she has, 50 or 60 in her account. So I think you want to be sure to do it before she retires.
Mr. Hughes, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, the $32,000 is the amount owed by Minsky. The amount for the employee is actually $29,417.90.
Hearing none and seeing no other questions, gentlemen, thank you for being here. Ms. Dene, thank you. Senator Representative Tice, thank you. We will lay this over for possible inclusion in the 2016 Pensions Bill. With that, Representative Knobloch will ask you to come forward, and this is another as I mentioned before, number 8, similar but not the exact same item that involving the same person that Representative Tice's situation did. But with that, I'm going to ask Representative Knobloch to stand by. We'll ask Rachel to give us some background on this, and then we'll go to Representative Knobloch with his presentation. Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill is also an individual constituent bill, and it allows Ms. Janelle LeBlanc, who's a current Minsky employee, to elect retroactive to July 2001 and prospective TRA retirement coverage for her Minsky academic advisor employment, and then she'll have to pay back a para refund. That's a requirement under statute. And sort of just a little background on the issue, Ms. LeBlanc was hired in her current position as an academic advisor, and pursuant to Minsky statute, she was eligible upon that employment to make a one-time irrevocable retirement coverage to switch from the IRAP account, which she is currently contributing to, and switch that to TRA coverage. And once an individual was given that sort of information from their employer, they were supposed to sign an election form acknowledging that they received the information. And Minsky can currently not find a form signed by Ms. LeBlanc, and Ms. LeBlanc states that she was never provided that information. So this is another example of a potential error on Minsky's part that deprived Ms. LeBlanc of her chance of electing TRA coverage.
Representative Knobloch, welcome. State your name for the record, and then if you have some additional things to add that should be for the Commission's consideration, we'd like to hear those. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jim Knobloch, members of the Commission, Members, I don't know that I have a whole lot to add. I've spoken to Ms. LeBlanc, corresponded with her a number of times. She regrets she can't be here this evening. She actually had a medical appointment at the end of the day today and just was unable to come after that time. It's pretty much as Ms. Barth talked about, and you've got the write-up before you. She's a Minsky employee. She was in the IRAP plan underneath statute. She had the option to convert to TRA coverage. She doesn't remember ever being given that option. Minsky can find no record that she was ever given that option. And given that, I would ask for your consideration in allowing to now have given her or to now give her that option.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. Questions for Representative Knobloch? Seeing none, hearing none. Mr. Hughes and Mr. Dale, I know that you had testified previously. I don't know if you need to testify on this, if you're going to stipulate that the paperwork didn't exist. And headshakes don't necessarily show up in the public record on audio, so if one of you come down and just verify for us that that was the issue, that would be helpful. Mr. Hughes.
Excuse me, Derek Hughes with Minsky, and yes, that is correct. Minsky does not have evidence of form to prove that Ms. LeBlanc was offered her opportunity to elect TRA, and Minsky finds it to be a fair resolution and that it follows precedence with the employee's election at hire.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Other questions for the testifier or Representative Knobloch for staff on this? Again, we will lay this over for possible inclusion in the 2016 omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the commission.
Oh, actually, I do need to go back for one other item here. I am in error on this. Ms. Lincheski, you might want to background us on this. I think we needed a technical correction to this, which we do have an amendment. And with that, I'm going to ask Ms. Lincheski to help us to get it in the form that we would like so that when we do take this up on the later in the session, that we do have the proper form. Ms. Lincheski, and members, I apologize. We'll bring that back.
Mr. Chair, if I...
I'm sorry, Ms. Barr.
No, it's fine. This is just purely technical. I had forgotten to make an explicit effective date, so this just adds that this section is effective the day following final enactment.
Mr. Chairman, I move the 1A.
Senator Pappas moves the 1A amendment to Bill 3422. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Now we will lay it over for possible inclusion in the 2016 omnibus pension bill. With that, what I'd like to do is I'd like to have Senator Pappas come in because I do have the final item before us this evening and have her chair that particular portion of the discussion. And I know we have a few testifiers that want to visit on the matter here as well. So with that, I will ask Senator Pappas to take the chair.
Over. Representative O'Driscoll, do you have a House file number yet?
We are pending that. It should be tomorrow at our introduction, or tomorrow or Thursday at our introduction. So I don't have a number as of yet, but I do believe there's a reference on here to an LCPR number that we could use this evening.
Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you want the staff to explain it?
Why don't I explain and the staff can supplement for me. Thank you for asking on that, Senator Pappas. Mm-hmm. This issue is almost as old for me as I've been in the legislature. In 2012, I was working on some legislation that dealt with changing the minimum amount that can be earned by an employee that would be PERA eligible. And in 1998, we had $425 was the minimum amount of monthly earnings that an individual needed to make to be eligible. At that time, minimum wage was $3.35 an hour. Since that time, it has escalated to $9.50 when we start looking at August 1st of 2016. We've worked on this ever since I've been on the Pension Commission, and Senator Pappas and I know this issue intimately because we've been back and forth on it, and we thought we had a cure on this, but I was hearing from local units of government, particularly from my district, who are saying, thanks for the effort on that, but by converting it from a monthly to an annual, we're still having some problems. What might those problems be? Well, number one, you have somebody who temporarily goes over that limit, It's not detected by the school district or the city or whoever is required to pay that. And then what happens is PARA does their audit, notifies the district or local unit of government, hey, you should have made this withholding. Go take care of that. The school district tries to find the employee and explain to them that they need $72.49 for the amount of money that they went over. And they say, but I don't want to be in the pension. Well, you might not want to be in the pension, but the law says we were supposed to collect that from you. So if you'd just be so kind as to make that check payable to the local unit of government for $72.50, we'll go ahead and we'll take care of that problem for you. Well, what ends up happening is the individual can apply for that money back, but then there's a bureaucratic process that goes through. And, oh, by the way, the local unit of government also has levied a penalty from PERA and for not having dealt with this issue going forward. What I'm asking for is an escalator that would be keeping more in keeping with the times of a 30-year period of time, and not just taking it from $425 a month, making it an annualized number, and then indexing from there. Everything else that we've seen has been kind of ratcheting up over time, and I'd like to first and foremost let the commission know that our problem hasn't been solved by bringing this forward, so we don't lose track of it. And I know that we have other testifiers, Madam Chair, so with that I will just postpone any other comment until we hear from some of their testifiers.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. O'Driscoll, Representative O'Driscoll, for now? Then why don't we bring forward then Ann Finn and Keith Carlson. Are you here? There they go. I think you can grab that other chair right there, maybe.
Madam Chair, one looks like Ann, the other one doesn't.
Welcome to the Pension Commission. Who's going to go first?
Madam Chair, members,
Mr. Carlson.
Doesn't look like Ann. Keith Carlson, Executive Director, Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of four of the suburban counties and 10 greater Minnesota counties containing the regional centers. Our organization does not have a formal position on this bill, but however, want to thank Representative O'Driscoll and the Pension Commission to continue to focus on issues that cause PERA to make expenditures that frankly are out of line with the other pension systems. PERA currently shares the distinction with TRA of having the highest employer contribution, yet our basic benefit or our service credit is nearly 12% less, and our cost of living increase is half of what MSRS and TRA is at 1% rather than 2%. So basically, we do want to encourage the commission to look at proposals such as this that would cause cost reductions. You do, as part of your packet, have an actuarial study that looked at this issue back in 2013. That study was based on an annual salary of about $9,300 and provided relatively nominal savings for the plan. So we would certainly like to see what a higher limitation of $14,800 annually would provide, and if that's would provide savings, would like to come back and give a more would like to be able to debate that with our organization, come back with a formal position. But again, we appreciate that Representative O'Driscoll, as well as Senator Pappas, keeps this issue in front of the commission. I'll just mention one other concern that hasn't been identified for me is how we deal with individuals who come into a training class for a deputy sheriff who does not have a position at the time he or she graduates from that class. Specific concerns have been brought forward to me by one of our counties about how that individual is handled. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Carlson? And welcome to the Pension Commission, Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're doing performance reviews in the chairs, so I'm sitting in. I'll be distributing surveys for all the members of the commission as well.
I'm just the vice chair.
I'm aware. I said it properly. It's the chair that we're.
Ms. Finn.
Good evening, members. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. And
We can vouch that Representative O'Driscoll's been doing just a fabulous job managing the commission. wanted to echo the comments made by Mr. Carlson. We, like Micah, have experienced some of the issues that Representative O'Driscoll identified with, especially temporary and seasonal employees who come in and maybe just make it to that threshold of being eligible for PERA, but have no desire or intention to stay in public employment. And having those people coming in and out really does create some complexities at the payroll level at the local unit of government, and sometimes frustrates the individuals who are paying for, even though they can take it when they leave, who are paying into the PERA plan when they would prefer to have that money for things like tuition or other things that they're working for as I said, temporary and seasonal employees. So we don't know that this is the perfect answer, but we think it's something that we're happy the commission is discussing, and we'd like to be part of the conversation.
Any questions for Ms. Finn? I guess I just wanted to make a comment. I remember this discussion we've had, and it seems to me we're dealing with kind of two issues, and add or correct me if I'm wrong. One is kind of some paperwork complexity that costs money and creates some local government issues versus us wanting low-wage workers to save for retirement. It's what we've talked about over the years. And so we don't know for sure if this person is going to be just a one-season employee, if they're just a student and that's it, or how many of these seasonal employees do you have coming back year after year after year, and it's really much more of a, you know, a job that they rely on as on a long-term basis. In that case, they should be saving a little bit toward retirement. So I think we have to keep talking about this a little more. I don't know if we found the right answer yet. And we do have one more person who wants to testify. So that is Ms. Lawrence. Leverance. Sorry, I pronounced your name wrong twice.
German and Polish.
And Ms. Blyle. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. She's going to start.
Ms. Blyle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5, and begin by saying this is not a new issue to us. We have expressed concerns with this issue as it's been before the Commission in past years. And at a time when we should be looking at retirement security, particularly for those that have the least ability to save for retirement, this is going in the wrong direction. We have members affected by this proposal, negatively affected by this proposal, but our sister council, Council 65, has many more members, and I'll turn it over to Sarah to speak for them.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Leverins. I represent AFSCME Council 65, which strongly opposes this proposal. And I'd like to give you some people to have in your mind as you consider this issue. First, there's Tammy, who is a school bus driver. She starts her day at 5:30 a.m. when she begins driving her bus to school. She's expected to have a 100% error-free drive every day, while dozens of friendly and well-behaved school children sit behind her. She doesn't work when the school is on break or holiday, so that brings her salary down. And she doesn't make enough money to have a 401k and will rely heavily on her Social Security and PERA pension if she is ever able to retire. Because she works part-time at one of the lowest-paid jobs in the school district, she would not be eligible for a PERA pension under this bill. Then there is Liz. She is a part-time school cook. She comes in at the crack of dawn to get lunch started. She doesn't make a lot of money, but she works for the school district, so she can be covered by the employer's group health insurance, a large portion of which she pays for herself, making her paychecks awfully small. Liz, too, would not be eligible for a PERA pension under this bill. Then there are the many nursing assistants who work in local government-owned nursing homes doing extremely important jobs that none of us could do. If these folks work full-time, they make enough to be covered by para. But a nursing assistant who works half-time and makes $10 an hour, a good salary for a nursing assistant at a nursing home, that person would not be eligible for a para pension under this bill. These people work as hard as any other para member. They just earn less doing jobs we need done. So why are we considering sentencing them to work into their 70s or 80s? I understand that there's an issue with temporary and seasonal people. I'm concerned whether, as the chair pointed out, that those people keep coming back, because I know a lot of those people who work for the parks in the summer or whatever it is. But this is not the answer, because there are a lot of real low-wage workers who would be hurt by this proposal.
I guess if we all, I don't know if that we all have this. We had it in 2012, which was the membership eligibility study. There is an option here, three, that would use length of employment instead of financial number to determine who's eligible for para. And I'm wondering if, you know, the people you're talking about are probably working at least 9 months during the school year, whereas the people that are of concern that Representative Driscoll is talking about are the seasonal employees that are just working for the summer for 3 months. And sometimes they come back and sometimes they don't. But the nine-month employees tend to, I would imagine, tend to come back.
Senator Leverance. One of the things that, I mean, that would be have to be something we could take a look at. I read the study and met with Ms. Vanek about it in 2012, 2013, whenever it was. That was not a proposal that had any legs at the time. It didn't go anywhere. So I think we need some time to really think about it and talk about it if that was something that the commission wanted us to think about.
Sounds like the commission wants you to think about it.
Yes, Senator.
Representative Thiessen.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So the way this works is that under, if it's projected you're going to make under a certain amount of money, you wouldn't be eligible, and if and otherwise you would be, and that's kind of what the
Madam
law
Chair,
is now.
Did you want me to answer that? I said, for better or for worse, I'm the resident expert on this one. Representative Thiessen, what happened was we had school districts in particular who approached me and said, you know, $425 a month, that's the threshold. And so they might have somebody who was working in the lunch program, and then there were some shifts that they were eligible for to pick up somewhere else, and they bumped over that $425. And so it was 1 month you might be over, a couple months you aren't, then you're over. And so there was this constant rolling. So we thought, well, if we put it into an annual number, where they might take a look at it from the school district and say, okay, over that 9 or 12 month period of time, what could they be looking at? And then any individual month, they could make over $425, and it would go against the aggregated number. What I'm hearing from school districts right now is that aggregated number that we've converted to a few years ago still isn't solving the administrative problem, and quite frankly is creating some angst with those employees who they have to go back and knock on their door and say, can you write the check to help out us comply with the law on this? Quite frankly, if they don't, the school district is on the hook to be able to pay both the employer and the employee part of that.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. So this language stipulated in advance in the statute. So if they're stipulated to make $5,100 under the current law in advance, and then they bump over $5,100, then you have to. What are the words stipulated in advance? Seems like if that's what you're guessing it's going to be, and then they bump over. How does that language play into
this
that?
Question to Ms. Lencheski?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know exactly what the paperwork is, that where you stipulate this in advance. My understanding is that they have people in certain positions, and their estimate is the amount of dollars they're going to make in that position is something that they have a pretty solid estimate on, so they're able to then just determine that they're not going to fall into this this category and have to start paying into para. The idea is, though, that if they accidentally do go over the amount, then you look back to the month where they first exceeded the monthly amount, I think, of $425, And at that point, then they are in para.
Oh, not the whole year.
So the amount is $425 a month. So that only comes up if they exceed that annual amount. And that would be a situation where the estimate that they had thought would be able to be stuck with in terms of the dollars for that period, either school year or calendar year, is exceeded.
Ms. Bonchesky, they could exceed 1 month and be under the next month, but if the overall year they didn't exceed, then they wouldn't go back to that month. Only if the overall year they exceeded, then they go back to the first month where they exceeded 425, correct?
That's my understanding.
Madam Chair, it might be helpful to have Ms. Jones from PERA come up at this point.
I don't know if we want all that detail, though. So, right. Representative Thiessen.
If we're not going to act on it, I don't need to get the answer to that question.
Okay.
Right now, we can wait on that.
Any other discussion?
Senator Pappas, I would still ask that Ms. Jones have the opportunity to speak. She was added to the list that I had.
Okay.
Which I brought down here. So.
Right. Did Ms. Blau and Ms. Leverance finish? Okay, great.
Thank you.
Ms. Jones.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
So just quickly, Senator, the biggest problem for the employers is the burdensomeness to administer. Is that correct?
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Johnson, that is what is being reported to me by the local units of government, that it's the keeping track of this, and with a large number of people coming and going, hires and terminations and different things, they have a lot of things to keep track of. And all of a sudden, oh, here comes a letter from PERA, you should have done this for this person because you've hit the max or you didn't collect. And they're just asking for the opportunity to be able to find a way to be able to not subject the taxpayer to a penalty because they missed that, as well as being able to honor the request of somebody who's working on more of a temporary basis. Who's looking to get money to go to college or to do some other things. And the real intention isn't necessary to be a full-time public employee under a covered plan. And therein lies the dilemma.
Okay, Ms. Jones or Mr. Anderson? Ms. Jones.
Shana Jones, Policy Director at PERA. Madam Chair, the madam threw me off. I was used to saying Mr. So I think that there's a couple of things at play here, like you mentioned. It's sort of what's the right coverage level and who's it for, and that's a really big conversation that we're probably not going to tackle in this room here tonight. It's been, 4 years, and so we still have some concerns about it. So I do think it's ripe for conversation, and there's a lot of different views. In the past, I think when Ms. Vanek worked on the issue, really wasn't able to get to a place where everybody felt great about where it ended, and so it comes back up again. To Representative O'Driscoll's comment about the membership and local government units having a penalty, we did develop an administrative practice where the employer would report an individual on a provisional basis because they were concerned about that. So what happens now is they report them if they're unsure, and then it's considered sort of a temporary membership basis, and then we figure it out once everything is said and done so that there's not interest collected retroactively.
Any other questions? Mr. Anderson, did you have anything you wanted to add?
This is Doug Anderson, Executive Director of PERA. I would just like to comment about the costs of the potential legislation. When this was done in 2012, the study was based on an increase of raising the limit from 5,100 to about 9,300. That's about doubling the limit. This proposal would about triple it, roughly. And that cost study at that time showed the cost is negligible. But one thing we know about actuarial results, they don't extrapolate well. So I think we'd want to be cautious about studying this again to make sure that we know how many people are affected and what the average change in service is. And I don't think it'd be safe to conclude that the cost would be negligible. It could be a cost or a savings involved.
Thank you. Any other questions? Then I guess we're laying this over for
Chair, I was going to just tell you what I'd like to have done with this evening, and that is, as any one of the other members of the legislature in this commission, when a constituent brings something forward, you want to work on that, and this was brought to me by constituents in my district from school districts, and so I wanted to have the opportunity to bring it to the commission one more time. I'm not going to ask that I be treated any differently than the other folks that we have pending issues, so Madam Chair, I'm going to ask that we lay it over for possible consideration.
So done.
And inclusion.
Any other, are we ready to adjourn then, Representative Driscoll, or you want to come back?
Madam Chair, I may come back and just give people just a little bit of an update as to the route that we're looking at between now and the end. Thank you.
All right.
You might need something to put you to sleep tonight.
Members, just to give you a little bit of a roadmap, we have, in my mind, one, maybe two more meetings left of the Pension Commission this session, and that is to deal with open issues and a few other things that we have that have been pending. Given the shortness of the session, we do want to get the pension bill buttoned up and get it moving through the respective chambers so that we can take action on the legislation that we have. I'm still working on and hearing from members about concerns about the stabilization plans. Can we hold off on that a bit? Can we work on that a little bit more? Where can we go? How do we get that? Can we implement it in steps and phases? And so I'm working on a few things that I may have by the next meeting, a roadmap that I would like to share with the group about that as well, and how we may want to proceed with that for consideration by the commission. And we want to be as transparent as we can on this and take the right steps, because if you started doing the math, it's a $3+ billion resolution that we would be looking at on here. And I would just assume that we did it once and did it right than to do something kind of halfway right now and then have to go back and fix things, because as we clearly see by the bill that I just had, we didn't quite get everything squared away last time, and there's still some questions. And so I want to make sure that we're taking the appropriate time to move forward. So I will have some more information to share with members at the next meeting.
Representative Driscoll? I know we've gone over, but I just wanted to make one comment, is that I tell you the truth, I'm not sure that if that's a doable thing, to have a kind of a one-time fix that will just fix it, because I think there's just too much change in the market. And, you know, who would have thought that the demographics, although we knew they were moving, would have had such a big effect? And I just think this is something we have to regularly revisit, not every year, but, you know, every few years, maybe every 5 years, in order to keep our pension funds sustainable and on the right track.
Senator Pappas,
you don't want to work yourself out of a job.
Let me clarify where I was going with this, and I was trying to go quickly in the interest of time here, but I recognize that we'll have to do some managing and monitoring of this as information comes forward. What I was thinking is, if we start moving now with a half a solution, and that we want to look at implementing this because of the hit that it would have on our school districts and our state agencies and funding, and we're not in a budget cycle right now, next year, 2017 is a budget cycle, that we're making those right decisions, giving staff the opportunity to review the plan they have not, to let our actuary review it, and to see if there are other things that we want to be looking at to go forward on or move forward basis. So, as again I said, I'm still looking at a few things, and I will have more information at that point. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I also think that we have to weigh in, though, the possibility that if we don't do some things this year, it's going to be at least 3 years before we're going to be able to do it again. I have the opportunity, and frankly, I'm not willing to wait, but I know that I am just one vote.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Anyone else? With that, we are adjourned.
These are all just... Yeah.